Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. I am your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted and privileged to welcome an incredibly multifaceted individual, a YPO friend from Australia, Mr. Andrew R. Banks. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ash. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Andrew is the chairman of the Veneto Group, with its primary focus on general investing via banks and fund managers. He started off life as an actor in England and Sydney. He is the founding partner and producer of Leela Ninth Productions. He co-founded Morgan & Banks in 1985, which was one of the early adopters of the World Wide Web, and merged it with Monster in 1996. He is a steering committee member of the Edison Awards and Edison Universe. He has been a part of Shark Tank Australia for four seasons, and he just mentioned that his videos have got over 6 million views on YouTube. And as I mentioned right in the beginning, he's a fellow member of the YPO. Andrew, what an amazing journey you've had. So let's start with your telling me about your journey from an actor to human resources to investing, completely different businesses. What were your challenges and what were your learnings?
Well, you need to understand my early years, obviously, were in England. I grew up in England. I had a great education at a school in Chichester in Sussex, and I'm doing well in subjects like physics, chemistry, biology, zoology. And of course, you know, being a proud son, one of six boys, my mother says she wants me to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. So my first mistake in life was I thought I wanted to do medicine. Mm-hmm. Tried that for about 6 months and then transferred to applied biology because that was the nearest thing at London University I could get to. And I hated the sight of blood and the smell of formaldehyde. So, you know, oh no, Banks hasn't fainted again. And I think why it's relevant to my journey, as we'll talk about, I was a misfit. I was someone who, you know, frankly knew I was intelligent, but I didn't find my vocation early enough and the study was all wrong. So I dropped out. So I'm a university dropout. I'm in England. It's 1972. The place is depressing. There's a coal miner's strike. And I start a business while I'm at university. Suddenly realize making money is not hard. It's, you know, everything else. And I meet this Australian girl who's going back to Australia with her husband. And she says, oh, you know, we can get you in. They call me a 10-pound pom. Like, you know, you pay 10 pounds, the Australian government. It was assisted pension. I thought, well, what have I got to lose? I had hair longer than most women in those days. You know, this was Carnaby Street. So I think the interesting part of my journey is I went to Australia to sort of find myself, and I had no idea what I wanted to do, and therefore acting and a restaurant and these other things were really my early journey in thinking, what the hell do I want to do with my life?
Incredible. And moving now to Morgan and Banks, you were a very, very early adopter of the World Wide Web. I mean, people are just about trying to figure out how to handle emails. And you were setting up this incredible network of resumes of people. What did you spot so early on in the game?
Well, I think before that, I got into recruitment. So after I sort of made some money in the restaurant business or whatever, and as they say, sort of, you know, I cut my hair and got a real job. I met my wife. I found recruiting and I got into that, and that was going pretty well. Mm-hmm. And then we started Morgan & Banks in the early 80s, 86. And we built up to be quite a big business. We ended up with nearly a million resumes on file. And the period you're talking about is 1996, when you in Australia still had to go to Melbourne University and have a university professor write you a URL in a book. Mm-hmm. I remember morganandbanks.com.au. In those days, you know, we should have registered lots of other names. Hello. But the answer to your question is, when you are running a big recruiting business, we had nearly a million resumes, you realize that it's a two-sided marketplace. You need employers. They're the ones that pay you for good candidates for a job, but you need candidates. And so actually we weren't sort of geniuses that discovered the web so much as this is a really cheap way to get candidates. You don't have to pay a newspaper for expensive ads. those large ones or the small ones, the classifieds, as we call it, all over the world. Or you don't have to pay a researcher to do headhunting calls, depending on the level. Wow, at very small prices, I can create a digital ad and I can get more candidates. Mm. So that was really the genesis. And we had a very functioning web called JobHound in 96, 97. We were already doing nearly $2 million a year halfway through 97, early 98. Mm-hmm. And that's where this American company, TMP, discovered us, and we started to explore a merger.
Interesting. And, you've been working across multiple countries, multiple cultures. What was it like to manage global talent, and what were some of your challenges?
Yeah, well, I think the most important thing you have to realize is that there are huge cultural differences everywhere, even though the language may be the same. Interestingly, you're in India, I'm in Australia, and we speak a common language, but Indians and Australians would expect and respect the fact that managing businesses in India or Australia was very different. Right. The trick actually is when you go to countries like England or America and Australia, where you think, oh no, it'll be exactly the same. I found the United States one of my biggest challenges, because in Australia and in England, there was a sort of similar approach to things. So I think the most important thing for a CEO, I had 32 countries in the end, Poland, Malaysia, lots of Japan, is understand those differences, ask questions, be curious, and respect, get some local management that really is culturally aligned, but respect the fact that they say, Andrew, this is the right way to handle this particular issue here, particularly in the areas of employment. Employment's a sensitive issue. In China, it was very sensitive because we were cutting across what the Chinese communist system hitherto had what's called the hukou system, where you actually had to get permission to leave your part of China and go to work in another part of the town. That's changed a bit now, but it was sensitive. The government was watching closely.
But, what I've been wondering is that a lot of companies struggle to make it into so many different markets. And you were, operating in 40 different markets. What was the communication you were using to reach out to so many people? There was no social media.
I think it comes from this concept of me being a misfit. So Morgan was also a bit of a misfit. Mm-hmm. So you need to understand, if you think about the early days of recruitment consultants, they were either not doing a very good job and floating resumes and not really asking good questions, or they were a bit elitist. Mm. You remember PA management and all these companies were, and every ad said you had to have 3 degrees and an IQ of 193. Well, that was a very interesting, and that's where Monster was so successful. Mm. We took the other view and we said, everybody is an unrepeatable miracle. Every candidate who applies for a job should be respected and understood. Mm. And so we'll believe what you upload and take. Mm. And then we will say to the employers, we will help them do the sifting and selecting. Mm. And actually we were at a pivotal point where in the old 20 years ago, 30 years ago in recruitment, I would have said, you're paying me to find people. Today, there's billions of resumes out there. Now I'm saying you're paying me to select people, to match them. So I think back to your question, we were successful because we weren't elitist. We said anybody who wants to apply for a job should do so. We'll take you on face value, upload your resume, and then the selection process will begin, rather than screening at the front end saying, don't even talk to us unless you've got this or got that.
And one more question relating to human resources and Morgan and Banks and Monster before I move to the next segment. How have the expectations of human resource leaders changed over the last so many years?
There's been a huge change. And if I can bore your listeners with this theory that I have, is that in a recruitment exercise, I'm going to say all of us are SKNA, skills, the doing things, knowledge is the data loaded on the chip, the resume, and the skills are in the resume, and attributes, who you are as a person. And that's your passion, your cultural approach, the drivers of your life. And I think in HR in the last 20 or 30 years was very focused on S and K, what was on the resume. And I would call it, frankly, the rear vision mirror, what you used to do, what you used to think about, Now, with the help of technology, there's much more of a focus on attributes, how you think. And why technology has helped that is it's meant cost-effectively and quickly. You can do some cultural and attribute screening right up front. You can put a little questionnaire up there, 30, 40 questions that might be very important to how your company works, whether you're in fast food or steel or mining or other services. And you can therefore start to match people against this job in your company based on how you think, what drives you, what you're passionate about, how you like to be managed. And so that was too expensive before. Now technology's made that easier and faster. And that's the way you sift 4,000 resumes that you might get from a badly worded ad and filter it down to 40 that, irrespective of what's on the resume, what they used to think about, now how they think, this English school teacher who left her job 4 years ago, had two kids, and is now coming back into the workforce, is a superstar salesperson. Even she doesn't know that, but because she answers these questions that match your best salespeople, out she comes looking really good. So I think that's a very different shift from where we used to be, and I think that's one of the areas where technology's helped us, and I think level the playing field a bit. And to a lot of listeners who say, I was misjudged, you know, I qualified as a lawyer or as a mechanic or something, but that's not what I want to do in life. What I want to do in life is this. I wish people would hire me for that. That world is now emerging. And of course, that's very important in a labor shortage where perhaps the resume isn't doing it for you and you need to recruit on different criteria.
Fascinating. So, Andrew, let's now move to the next part of our conversation, which is about the Veneto Group. I hope I have the pronunciation correct. Where you make investments. So my first question to you as an investor is, what are some of the key metrics you look for before you decide on making an investment?
I start with the people. And, you know, that really is because I made a lot of decisions in my life by recruiting and selecting people. And that's the key thing for me. You know, are they aligned to my way of thinking? And digital products is really probably my main focus now, monster.com. I see the digital world as a parallel world. And I think, so I'm looking at the people, do they have a plan? Is the business scalable? You know, is it something that, you know, I'm not really that interested in things that are growing 3-5% a year. If I'm looking for that sort of investment, I'll give it to professional money managers for my capital. So I'm looking for the people, their alignment. And I'm definitely, I wouldn't call myself a social entrepreneur, but I'm very interested in businesses that might in a small way move the needle and make the world a better place. I happen to believe putting people in great jobs makes the world a better place. I like the idea of, you know, I've got investments in things that are as simple as shoe inserts, sink-sole, you know, where you put them in your shoes and your feet feel better, and so on. So I like the idea of things that, you know, maybe move the needle and make money, but also positive in a social sense.
And every investor I have spoken to, including my own investments that I do, there are always stories of ones that got away. Do you have any that you'd like to share?
Oh, huge. I mean, I can point to one investment worth $250 million that got away, which was Seek. Seek is the monster.com of the US, of Australia. And I had my foot on 5 to 10% of those shares at very modest sums, a $35 million valuation. It's now worth $7 billion. And I was just a bit slow. And somebody came in, an institution came over the top of me because I just got back from America. We'd seen monster.com grow from $18 million to $900 million online in 6 years. So, I mean, right under my nose. And I'd say, you know, certainly that would be the biggest one. But, you know, you can't win them all. And I'm happily, I've backed a couple that have become unicorns as well in different areas, you know. So ABC Mouse is one of them, which is a literacy platform in the US, which is good. And I'm very excited about Juvenescence, which is an anti-aging platform run by Jim Mellon and his team. And I'm an early investor in that business. So yes, some that got away, being a bit slow. But that one shouldn't have, because it was right in my wheelhouse.
I agree. And one more question on the Veneto investments. At what stage do you look for an exit?
I think the short answer is I don't so much get preoccupied with the exit, but I look for either dividend income or a return within 3 years. So I'm looking to try and get some income back or my capital back within 3 years. And then, depending on the business, I may live with it and stay the distance, or if they go public and there's an opportunity and it seems like the right thing to do to just exit completely, that's what I'll do. So I like the idea of taking my money off the table or getting income within 3 years.
Okay. Let's move on now and talk about the Edison Awards and the Edison Universe. Tell me about these awards, which are committed to inspiring educational institutions and supporting the business world.
It's a not-for-profit, US-based, and it was obviously based on Edison, who, as we all know, historically, along with, maybe Mr. Tesla himself, mm-hmm. not the car company, but the Mr. Tesla, you know, was one of the great, but I think Edison was more ubiquitous and more prolific, you know, thousands of patents. And he was really someone who collected a team together. Mm-hmm. And really believed in, you know, you try different angles. So the Edison is a not-for-profit. It encourages innovation all over the world. I'm one of probably 25 steering members on the committee, and we mm-hmm. look at awards each year, and we all make assessments. They're all in various categories: technology, lifestyle, services, consumer. Mm-hmm. And it's a very exciting thing. And for me, it's a window on what's coming. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, last year, for example, some of the winners were hybrid electric airplanes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, airplanes that actually, you know, double or triple fuel efficiency by being hybrid. So, you know, we think of that mm-hmm. in motor cars, but this is an airplane. Or there was a body sensing device called IoBid, which is a bed that you lie on, and it measures how you're lying and where the pressure points are, and then the bed adjusts to give you the perfect sleeping position. So you go from hybrid planes to a bed. Well, we all need a comfortable bed, right? A good night's sleep, we know, is good for health, things like that. And then, you know, I love the Impossible Sausage last year was one of the winners, which was a synthetic plant that tastes exactly like sausage. We all love a good sausage roll or a hamburger meat. Okay. So that was one of the winners too, the Impossible Sausage. So that shows you how diverse it is. But there's that's about 100 winners in different 10 in each category, and it does what we expect it to do. It really encourages innovation from all over the world.
Hmm. And the people who are at the top amongst the winners, do you also look at investments in these companies or no?
They get a huge window to investors. All the winners are seen by the VC companies and the early startup companies. They get a lot of marketing support. And then they actually pick up mentors too through the program. So we offer them, you know, where there are gaps, mentoring of us. Because as we know, I mean, how good would it have been if that was sort of the good thing to do and you and I were perhaps starting out? Because getting mentors was not as easy in those days. So very, very important help along the journey. Yes.
Fascinating. So, Andrew, I'm going to move to another exciting part of your life, which is Shark Tank Australia. Tell me about how you got involved and what you were doing and some of your learnings.
Well, I just sold Talent 2, which was my second public company. I was, you know, that classic sort of mid-60s, what do I do, boards and things. And I'd moved back to California where my daughter and son were for a few years just to look at some investments in Silicon Valley and in the US. And they auditioned me from Australia. And I always remember, because if you watch Shark Tank in the US, they're pretty tough, you know. They say things like, you're dead to me and out of here. And they said to me, I'm happy to be tough on bad ideas, but I'm not going to be on television bullying people. I'm not going to shoot the messenger. I might shoot bad ideas. Anyway, they liked the approach. So we did 4 seasons on Channel 10 and it went really well. It's a Sony owns the franchise globally. It's called The Den. It's something Den in the UK and Dragon's Den. That's it. It's called Dragon's Den in the UK and Canada. It's called, anyway, it's done very well, 48 seasons. And I guess what I liked about it was it kept me in touch with Australia. It kept me in touch with entrepreneurs. And, you know, it was all filmed over 3 or 4 weeks. You'd get 7 pitches a day. Mm. Imagine being in a studio, getting 7 pitches, and you have no idea what's going on until they come on. Mm. And it really keeps you on your toes. And I got exposure to probably 15 businesses or 20 businesses over those seasons that I wouldn't have normally invested in. And I've had a lot of fun with it.
Fabulous. So, Andrew, I'm going to move to the last segment. All my viewers and listeners love to get to know my guest a little more. So my first question to you is that how do you handle such a diverse range of interests?
Well, I think I'm very organized as a person. I look at a diary plan and I plan what I will do and what I won't do. I've always been a great believer that sometimes success comes from what you say no to. So I'm very specific about time and where I spend that time. And I, you know, whilst they seem diverse, you know, innovation, Shark Tank, you know, the Edisons, my own investing, there's a common ground there, a common thread there, which is what I call divergent thinking, which is I want to look at what is possible, not convergent thinking, which is just, you know, a systematic approach to success. I make certain times in my day, I balance that with staying fit and family life and, you know, other things. And so, I've made sure that what I call the span of control, which is what you're talking about, doesn't ever sort of, you know, get out of hand. I mean, like everyone, some of those spinning plates fall off from time to time, but I make sure that they're not the same plane all the time and that they're not the important life-threatening ones.
Yeah, yeah. Well said. So I have time for 2 more questions. And my next question is, from where you stand in life today, you've achieved so much. You've got such an amazing public profile. What does success mean to Andrew?
I think success for me, I didn't have, you know, expectations. Certainly didn't think a lot about money when I came to Australia with nothing. So I suppose I'm the thing I'm happiest about is I interviewed people for a living and I know how few of them loved what they did. And I'm happy to say that I'm one of those few that was, I found my vocation late in my late 20s after acting and restaurant and medicine and all those things. So I loved listening to people, unrepeatable miracles like you, interviewing them and finding something in their backgrounds that they didn't see and helping them find the next step. So I'm very happy. I think it is one element of success to find that thing that we all search for, that we love what we do, and to make a living out of it. And then, you know, generally, I mean, you know, I don't call family a success, but I have a happy, loving family. But I think the other thing is I have been successful financially. I'm financially independent, which means I can make my own choices.
Correct.
And I think what I like about my particular journey is I can't think of many enemies. So I've always seen when I've interviewed people, and I often call it the difference almost between good and evil. When you interview people and listen to their language, some people have this algorithm of success, which is for me to be successful, you have to fail. I don't have that algorithm. I've always believed that for me to be successful, others can be successful around me. So I feel good about that in the sense that I'm not sitting here talking to you, patting myself on the back and saying, hasn't it been great? And I've got a whole bunch of people in my life that are sharpening their knives if they could ever come across me. I don't have that. So I feel I can sleep at night. So I think that's another element of success I'm happy with.
Fascinating. And my last question to you, and this is for the many, many people who listen to our conversation. What would your advice be to a young entrepreneur who's starting off on her or his journey?
Well, and my journey was a really difficult one, not difficult, but checkered in my early years. And somehow, and I think I thank my parents for this sort of value. They always said, look, whatever you do, make every step a winner. So don't you know, a lot of people get frustrated on their early journey. This isn't really what I want to do. So they do that job that they're in now badly. Don't do that. So do make every step a winner. Do every job you're doing, even if you're serving sandwiches or selling door to door, or you're an intern at a hospital, do it well. And be positive and have tone about that, because that will lead to the next step. So I think that, you know, that's a very important thing. And then the second thing is curiosity, because the thing that disappoints me most about people like you and I of my generation is that they, you know, if I come across anybody who thinks they know it all and they've got nothing more to learn, I feel sad. And I think curiosity is a great quality. It's, you'll get much more out of life by being interested than being interesting. Because you know all those. So be curious, ask questions, keep learning, and you'll do really well.
Amazing. On that note, Andrew, thank you so much. It's been such a privilege speaking to you. Thank you for taking me and all our viewers and listeners down your incredible journey. And I just keep wishing you many, many more new things that you seem to be so passionate about. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.